Good morning, Mr. Doss.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mike Doss and I represent Appellant Sidley Austin in this case. With me at counsel table is Darcy Proctor, who's counsel for School District 100. I will be presenting the argument for the entire joint brief that we submitted on behalf of both Appellant Sidley Austin and School District 100. Your Honors, as you know, the issue in this case concerns the appropriate scope of the attorney-client privilege and work product doctrines. And I'd like to begin with some important background to Sidley Austin's engagement in this case. Back in January of 2005, the school board of District 100 in Illinois faced what could be termed a perfect storm of really horrific news. First, in January of 2005, a band teacher at School District 100 was arrested on criminal charges for sexual abuse of children while at the school under his instruction. Second, 10 days later, a civil complaint was filed against School District 100 and against Mr. Spurlick, the band teacher, as well as against a principal for the school district. And that civil complaint alleged that this misconduct that had been identified in the criminal complaint had been ongoing for years. It also alleged that certain unidentified school district employees had awareness of the misconduct and failed to appropriately report the conduct to legal authorities or to follow appropriate internal procedures in response to becoming aware of the misconduct. And in addition, there was a claim in that complaint that stated that the school district had failed to employ appropriate procedures and compliance programs to both identify and rectify the misconduct that was alleged.
So, Mr. Doss, just to be clear, that case, the civil case of which you're now speaking, names only the district itself, Mr. Spurlick, and the principal as defendants, not individual members of the school board and not other school employees?
That is correct, Your Honor. That
Are
was the initial
later?
Complaint.
Okay, right. And so who gets added, if anybody, as defendants?
The complaint is amended a number of times over the years, and it then is subsequently amended to include, after Sidley's involvement in this case, a number of individual school board members, including the school board president, Joanne Zindel, is named as a defendant in the action, and other school board members are named later on in the case.
That's after the Sidley investigation.
That is after the Sidley investigation, yes, Your Honor. At the time of the investigation, the complaint named the school district itself, a principal, and Robert Spurlick, the band teacher. In that context, approximately a week or 2 weeks later, Sidley Austin was engaged by the school board. This, as you can appreciate, was an unprecedented circumstance for the school board, and it in response to that, hired Sidley Austin to assist it in understanding what actions it should undertake. And an aspect of the legal services that Sidley was retained to provide included an internal investigation. An internal investigation directly in response to the civil complaint that was filed, which suggested and alleged that unidentified school district employees had been aware of the misconduct for a period of time and had failed to comply with legal requirements in reporting it to DCFS, the Department of Children's Services in Chicago.
Could I stop you for a moment?
Sure.
Because your time is going to run out before, and we've read these briefs extremely carefully. Why didn't Sidley take the district court up on its offer to review the documents in camera? In a way, it almost seems that the appeal is, you know, premature. Isn't it possible that the district court, seeing the documents in question, would realize that this was an attorney-client relationship?
First, Your Honor, the court had seen the documents that established the attorney-client relationship, which is the engagement letter between Sidley and the school district. But the core documents at issue in the motion by the plaintiffs and that were before the court were interview notes by Sidley counsel conducting interviews of school district employees. Those interview notes were clearly ordered to be produced by the district court, with its vision being that fact investigators, can't claim the attorney-client privilege, and that as fact investigators, those interview notes are subject to disclosure. The district court did allow for the possibility that certain other materials, such as analysis of compliance programs and compliance policies, that might not be subject to disclosure after in-camera review. But the core of the court's order, which we were obliged to comply with following it, was to produce the interview notes, and there was nothing to be gained, in our view certainly, by producing those interview notes to the court for its evaluation, because they were in fact what they pretended, what they suggested to be, which were notes of interviews of school district employees.
So is it your view that any time a lawyer is hired to investigate a situation, the attorney-client privilege automatically attaches as between that lawyer and the hiring client, or is there something special about either this case or this engagement letter that brings it within the attorney-client relationship?
I would say this, Your Honor. In almost all instances, an attorney hired to conduct an investigation, an internal investigation of alleged misconduct, will in fact create an attorney-client relationship, and the fact investigation that is undertaken will be protected by the privilege. But this case is special in that it fits within that large group of cases. We have an engagement letter that clearly on its face states that Sidley Austin was engaged as the attorney and that it was to provide legal services in connection with this investigation. That engagement agreement, the four corners of which, are clear and unambiguous, and in our view, the district court did not take proper account of the engagement agreement, which creates an attorney-client relationship by its terms. So this is not an instance where there was any basis for any question as to the nature of the services that Sidley Austin was providing.
Will the record tell us if there have been other instances in which Sidley has been chosen to do only investigative services?
There's nothing in the record, and I submit to the court that would be a remarkable and perverse engagement, that a law firm is engaged in the business of providing legal advice and services, and when an outside law firm is retained to conduct an investigation concerning misconduct, alleged misconduct, that naturally suggests and compels the conclusion that the law firm is providing legal services and that the factual investigation that is the prerequisite for the provision of legal advice and counsel is necessarily protected by the attorney-client privilege. And that's the lesson of Upjohn and the Supreme Court's Upjohn case, which in our view is in all fours with our case and which compels the conclusion that Sidley's interviews of District 100 employees, current and former, are protected by the attorney-client privilege, and that there's no basis for conclusion otherwise.
Now, the plaintiffs claim that you did not submit the affidavits upon which you now rely until the district court had ruled against you three times. Is that the case? That's my first question. And my second question, I guess, is how is it that Sidley did not know about this dispute sooner and didn't send an attorney to cover these hearings?
Your Honor, on the first question, Your Honor, it is not true. The affidavit of Scott Lazar, a partner at Sidley Austin, was submitted in response to the motion to show cause in this case. That affidavit clearly set, which was the initial response by Sidley to the motion that led to the order that we're here before the court on. In that affidavit, it set forth the legal relationship between the school district and the school board and Sidley, the nature of the investigation and the legal services provided. So that was done in advance of the district court's ruling. The additional factual material was presented in the motion for reconsideration, but that was entirely justified given the nature of the motion practice. The motion to show cause, which was denied, itself had no facts at all. It simply referenced an earlier order by the court and said, ordered that the court find Mr. Lessar in contempt for having failed to comply an earlier order that didn't apply to him. The court denied that, and in response, we presented Scott Lessar's affidavit. It was only in the plaintiff's reply brief that they submitted any factual evidence in the dealing with Sidley Austin's response. And that factual evidence is what's before the court, the various comments of Sidley providing investigative work for the school district. Let me address that point because I think it would be it's important for us to stress this, which is, in our view, there is no evidence before the district court that supports any conclusion but that Sidley was hired to provide legal services. The only evidence that the plaintiffs rely upon is not at all to the contrary. The plaintiffs identify first a letters and correspondence to school district parents where in that correspondence it states that Sidley or Scott Lessar was hired to perform an investigation, but it also states that Sidley was asked to provide advice on internal processes and procedures, so compliance programs. That's a traditional area of lawyer work. It's a traditional area of legal advice, and it clearly would be protected under the doctrine of attorney-client privilege, and we submit that it was. So that there was absolutely no evidence, in our view, that could support the conclusion that we were not providing legal services. And that goes to the heart of the district court's error, which is the district court attempted to took the statements that Sidley was hired to perform an investigation as somehow inconsistent with Sidley providing legal services. And the teaching of Upjohn is that are not at all inconsistent, that investigative work, factual investigative work, is in fact an aspect of legal work and legal services, and it's an appropriate area for protection of the attorney-client privilege. I've gone into my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve unless you have any questions.
The way I'm reading between the lines, and it's not entirely clear what the legal rationale for the district court's order was, but reading between the lines, it looks like the court was impressed with the public statements that were made by the board members in the letters that you've referenced and elsewhere in response to this crisis and the hiring of Mr. Lessar, that the plaintiffs suggest reflect that this is a public relations window dressing kind of an investigation rather than a true legal investigation. And that appears to be something that was influential to the district court, at least reading between the lines of his order. What's the response to that?
First, Your Honor, the items identified in our view cannot be read to suggest anything more than that Sidley was hired to conduct a factual investigation. But as I've mentioned, that is completely consistent with the provision of legal services and legal advice. Second, this extrinsic evidence cannot properly be viewed to trump the legal engagement letter, which clearly provides for the provision of legal services. There was no testimony that this was somehow a fictional investigation done to placate families and parents. In fact, the only testimony that is cited is the testimony of one of the board members who was asked, what did you do to investigate whether the school principal had complied with school policy? And the response was, we hired an outside firm to conduct an investigation. That establishes the basis for the privilege. It does not refute it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Lisko?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Samantha Lisko. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellees. The district court reviewed a variety.
Ms. Lisko, is your firm the only firm that has appeared for any of the plaintiffs?
I believe, Your Honor, that this appeal deals just with our firm's plaintiffs, but there are three other law firms, I believe, representing additional plaintiffs.
Right, because as we accumulated the disclosure statements, there were other firm names involved, and that caused me to become anxious. Maybe there were other firms.
We
can't evaluate disqualifications without knowing who's involved in the case.
We will make sure to get you under seal the full names of all the plaintiffs.
And the law firms. All you know, Judge Rovner's brother-in-law works for one of them.
That he would.
The district court reviewed a lot of evidence surrounding the South Berwyn School District's hiring of Mr. Lazar. And he concluded that in conducting his investigation, Mr. Lazar was not acting in his capacity as an attorney.
I don't see how he could have come to that conclusion, to tell you the truth. I mean, without thinking that there really was a chasm between putting on your hat as a lawyer and putting on your hat as an investigator, how can that be consistent with Upjohn, where the company was accused of making improper payments to foreign government officials, and the lawyers have to go around and check with all the employees of the company, who did you have lunch with, you know, what did you do, did you give them a diamond ring? That's a factual investigation, too.
Certainly, and factual investigations are done by attorneys on a regular basis for the purpose of providing legal advice.
And what does legal advice consist of?
Legal advice consists of advice, for instance, relating to litigation, to exposure, and an important fact in this case.
What about internal compliance programs? Antitrust lawyers do that all the time. They come up with, is that legal services or is that something else?
Certainly. And, Your Honors, Judge Hibbler's ruling that has been appealed here is limited to his documents related to the fact investigation, not to any.
That doesn't help us. Yeah.
The district court almost seems to be treating Sidley and Austin as a firm of private investigators rather than lawyers. I mean, why would the district hire some of the priciest lawyers in the city to conduct a simple fact investigation unless they wanted the investigation conducted with an eye toward the legal liabilities and future legal obligations of the district, as you mentioned? I mean, the court treated the interview notes as if the lawyers were mere scribes, like court reporters taking down information indiscriminately. But that's not how lawyers work. They will write everything down that they think is legally relevant and leave out things that they deem irrelevant. And every decision to write or not to write seems to me to have involved the exercise of discretion as a lawyer and reveals what the lawyer thought was important. It would be very difficult to redact such an account of interviews in a manner that did not reveal the attorney's thought process. I think you have a terribly high hill to climb.
That goes to the Sidley's claim that this is protected by the work product doctrine,
requires it's also attorney-client.
And attorney-client. Actually, the threshold for the work product doctrine in particular is that the materials be prepared in anticipation of litigation.
Let's go back to attorney-client, since there are only about two of these interviews that deal with work product. Why doesn't this reveal the lawyer's thoughts about legal exposure, the advice that's going to need to be given to a client, the matters on the scope of that advice?
The district had hired, before they hired Sidley, a firm to represent them in this litigation.
That's why I asked the question, who was involved in the litigation, because it seems to me the board members thought we better find out right now whether this is going to end with the district, the teacher, and the principal, or whether 16 other people are going to wind up before the court.
And, Your Honor, Ansel Glink had been hired before Sidley to defend the defendants in the litigation.
But if they may have conflicts of interest. Certainly the same lawyer couldn't represent the teacher in the district.
Certainly.
The principal may have been in a different position altogether. If the principal had the habit of stashing documents, you know, letters from children at the bottom of the file cabinet, it seems to me there, the assumption that one lawyer equals all lawyers, you know, you're finished, is simply not realistic.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to look at the extensive evidence that the district court relied on in coming to the conclusion that Sidley Austin was hired not in a capacity as a lawyer.
What worries me about all of the district court's discussion is it seems to be conducted inside the wrong framework.
The framework that the appellants are suggesting was incorrect here was not incorrect. The district court applied the well-established requirements for the attorney-client privilege, which includes that the attorney be hired in his capacity as a lawyer and be providing legal advice.
Your only answer to that is, oh, well, the engagement letter is boilerplate, mm-hmm. but the engagement letter says you are engaging Sidley Austin Brown and Wood LLP to provide legal services in connection with the specific representation as set forth above, and that's the investigation of the response to the allegations of sexual abuse, which certainly in most people's mind would invoke thoughts of legal liability, and you're engaged to provide legal services. What's unclear about that?
The letter is, we believe, clearly stating that this is an investigation.
But to provide legal service. Why are you reading those words out of the letter?
We're not reading those words out.
Yes, you are.
Well, the district court reviewed this as one piece of evidence, and if I may discuss
Can we stick with this piece of evidence for a minute? Because I think it's actually a really important one.
Your Honor, the cursory language on the second page, referring back to the specific scope of representation, this is legal services, the specific scope of representation is the evidence that the district court considered, and it's to investigate the response of the school administration to allegations of sexual abuse.
So did you respond? So, for example, these are children. I mean, DCSF gets involved in these kinds of matters. You know, did they or did they not comply with those? I can think of all sorts of legal questions that might come up.
And the specific scope of representation does not mention what legal questions are going to be answered.
Well, how could it? Well, no engagement letter that you write would ever say, and here are the following legal theories we're going to look into.
You know, this isn't a case where lawyers were providing business advice or personal advice. What we're looking at here is a highly charged investigation of the facts in order to determine the legality of the school board's actions and to provide advice for the board's legal obligations in the future if such a situation arose again. There's just no way to separate the legal from the investigative function in these circumstances.
Right. Respectfully, the appellants did not point to evidence in the record that showed that they were performing the investigation for the purpose of providing legal advice. And they sent, the board and the district sent two letters to all parents in the district stating, we have hired Mr. Lazar, a man with an unimpeachable reputation, to get to the bottom of what happened.
So it's crucially, why would you hire the former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois if you weren't really thinking that there was a legal overtone?
I believe that Mr. Lazar, with his unimpeachable reputation, would impress the parents that they were going to get to the bottom of what happened. They said, answers will be forthcoming. They promised the parents this. Answers were not forthcoming.
We are hiring the ex-FBI agent in charge to do, the investigation in that case. I mean,
hiring the former U.S. attorney indicates to the public that they are committed to getting to the bottom factually of what happened. That is something that former U.S. attorney can certainly do well, can conduct a thorough fact investigation and find out what happened. How is this allowed to continue if it did indeed happen? And they promised the public that answers would be forthcoming from the investigation.
And it would just stop there. And then Sidley and Austin would go off into the forest and allow some other law firm to come in and take over. I mean, even common sense-wise, does it really make sense?
The attorney-client privilege is limited.
See, I can't believe that your firm would really want the rule that you're arguing for to be the rule I know you think it's going to be helpful to you in this case, but what if in the next case you are representing, you know, a group of people who've suffered from employment discrimination, and you're out there interviewing each one of them, and you're taking down your interview notes to find out, you know, and what happened to you under this supervisor, and what happened to you under that supervisor? You wouldn't want those notes to be turned over as a factual account of what the supervisor did. You would consider that your factual investigation.
Possibly, and we are certainly not arguing for a rule. What Upjohn says...
if you win this case, well, that's the law in the Seventh Circuit.
I don't believe that's the case, because what Upjohn says is when a district court determines the applicability of the attorney-client privilege, it's a very fact-specific, case-specific analysis. So in Upjohn, the court determined that the investigation done there was for the purposes of providing legal advice. Judge Hibbler did a thorough investigation of all the facts in the record and determined here, in this investigation, that was not what the purpose was.
He gave the engagement letter extremely short shrift. And it seems to me that there isn't a legal rationale for permitting the letters to the parents to define the scope of the representation, or at least to give those letters priority over the engagement letter itself. That doesn't make any sense.
I don't believe that Judge Hibbler gave the engagement letter a short shrift. I think he looked at the specific scope of representation and determined this was a fact investigation.
What did he say about it?
Sorry?
What did he say about it?
He said that he considered it.
That's about it.
That's true. And there's no,
I don't
there is
know
no
how
written,
you can stand there and defend that.
There is no written opinion, but he did consider the engagement letter on numerous occasions. This issue came before Judge Hibbler over the course of 2 years. He's intimately familiar with the facts of this case and with the facts surrounding the hiring of Mr. Lazar. And this and the standard that applies here with this factual determination is clear error.
By the way, where in the record will we find the plaintiff's objections to the privilege logs as being inadequate?
There was objections to the district's privilege log as being inadequate, but I don't believe that there was a formal motion made objecting to Sidley Austin's privilege log. Your Honors, I would urge you to take a look at Appendix 140, which is Sidley Austin's three-page privilege log. In there, item number 6, for instance, lists the compilation of handwritten notes made by counsel throughout the investigation. They listed the privilege as applying there as solely work product, not as attorney-client privilege. These are some of the many pieces of evidence that Judge Hibbler looked at when determining that this investigation was not done in Mr. Lazar's capacity as an attorney. In addition, Judge Hibbler did not fail to recognize that amongst the documents that he ordered produced may be something that is subject to a privilege. So he told the district and told Sidley over and over again, feel free to come to me. I will take a careful look at any documents you believe are privileged.
But he did think that the fact accounts collected by the lawyers were not covered by the privilege. I don't think that's in doubt. I think he thought he was looking for, you know, and then we might assert this defense in case so-and-so is sued, and he would have redacted that note. But he was not prepared simply to say, the notes of your interview with the assistant principal detailing that person's experiences were privileged.
That's true, but he was willing to take a look at
it. So there's no point. I mean, if the real issue is privilege attaching to the lawyer's factual investigation, then there was no more process to go through with him.
Regarding the claims of work product privilege, as I mentioned before, at the time that Sidley Austin was hired, the district had representation for the litigation. And what Lazar represented and what they presented to the public was...
Do you need a reset? Sorry.
Oh, no problem.
Go ahead.
They presented Lazar as something different, something apart from that litigation. And by doing that, they had the benefit of using Mr. Lazar and his firm to represent their commitment to getting to the bottom of things, to transparency. Once again, they stated, we will let you know what our investigation uncovers. And what that shows is that this investigation was not primarily motivated the creation of the documents was not primarily motivated by aid in the litigation. If the district had wanted an investigation done with an eye towards explaining their exposure to defending them in the litigation, they could have had Ansel Glink, their lawyers in the litigation, perform that investigation. They did not, and for this reason, the threshold requirement for the work product doctrine is not met. There is a firm trial date in this case of August. The plaintiffs are all most of them are going back to school in the fall. And what we ask this court, in addition to affirming Judge Hibbler's ruling, is that because the appellants have failed to take the district court up on its repeated offer to look at the documents specifically for applicability of privilege, that they not be permitted to do that now. If the appellants are able to have the court determine the specific applicability of privilege and then presumably appeal any adverse ruling to this court, the plaintiffs will effectively have no ability to use these non-privileged documents at trial. And so we would ask this court to affirm in a way that preserves the plaintiff's right to access these documents.
Thank you, Ms. Kaiser.
I believe I've already used my rebuttal time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to respond to them. I do have a fuller response to one question that was raised earlier that I've confirmed now that all of the school board members are now defendants in this lawsuit, but they weren't previously. But if there's any other questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.